This is News in No Time at Gordon. On today's roundtable, the teaching of hate and tort reform, is it working? Joining us from our New York bureau, Kevin Powell, author of Who's Going to Take the Weight? Manhood, Race, and Power in America. Renee Amore, president of the Amore Group, is joining us from a member station WRTI in Philadelphia. And Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender, is at member station WBEZ in Chicago. Guys, thanks for joining us. Before we get into what we're going to talk about, I want to raise a question to each of you that Jamal Bryant brought up in the interview just a moment ago, and that is the idea of the sexy side of leadership. As we take a look at the question of who's going to take the mantle and who's going to lead us into the next millennium, Roland Martin, let me start with you. It seems to me, again, back in the day, to use the phrase, that leadership was always intoxicating, but the enticement of leadership and the fame that comes along with it came after the fact. Many people now say it's in the fore, that people who are entering leadership now want the fame first and then want to correct the problems and find solutions after they receive the fame. Do you buy that?
I do buy it. I think in many ways we are in the age of television and radio and the internet, and so therefore that somehow props you up and builds you up. And so I think that that is certainly the case because we tend to revel around individuals. I just had this conversation yesterday, and it was an interesting conversation because many folks don't want to do the work that is required of leaders, but they certainly want the accolades of being a leader.
Kevin Powell, has the idea of reality television and everybody being a celebrity found its way into the civil rights movement, or are we making too much of it? Because, again, history will show us others who led these organizations became iconic figures later, but certainly had a bit of celebrity during their time.
Well, I think part of the problem starts with many of the folks of the civil rights era who survived the civil rights movement and clearly have become celebrities or iconic figures who don't have real organizations, yet they have these grand national conferences, spend lots of money. You can't go a week of the year without them being in the media in some form, and they've been perceived to be leaders, but they actually don't have real constituencies. And I think that mindset has certainly trickled down to many people in their 30s and 20s. Who think that that's the way to become a leader. I think part of the problem is that many of the folks in the civil rights generation and the hip-hop generation really want to be famous more than actually do the real grunt work that it takes on a daily basis to be organizers in the community.
Mm-hmm. Renee?
I definitely agree with both your guests. I think that people are not even dealing with issues or solutions. It's about making money, and that's the bottom line for folks. It's important for them to be out there on television, radio, looking good, feeling good, propping up themselves, and not really dealing with any agenda.
Yet, Kevin, there will be those who will suggest that those like myself sit on the sidelines with a microphone or a camera in front of them, complain and complain and complain, and don't do enough about changing the solution, the situation. What about the Indians? Are Indians doing enough?
Indians? You mean the regular
Indians
folks?
In the sense of...
He's saying literal. Lots of chiefs, but not
yes,
enough.
Sir. Lots of chiefs.
I'm still waking up, brother.
I understand.
Well, you know, I think to me, and I live in Brooklyn, New York, brother, you know, and as I've said before in this show, I've been doing community work for 20 years, and it's not been glamorous at all. There are a lot of people who want to do the work and do the work. The problem is that, you know, we don't get the attention. I can name you about 50, 60, 70 young leaders around the country with names like Malika Sanders in Alabama, Angela Brown in Atlanta, Georgia, Ed Garns in Atlanta, Georgia, people like Tim Jones in Washington, D.C. These people do exist, and there are constituencies that they do have. The problem is that the media oftentimes doesn't pay attention to the folks who are doing the real work. They pay attention to the folks who we call these grand civil rights leaders, who we know really don't do any work and really don't have any real constituencies and don't even have real organizations. They're actually shells of organizations.
So, Roland, is this much ado about nothing in the sense of historically that it was always the case? When you look back at the NAACP, for instance, it was the local chapters that did far more work than the national.
Well, but I think you have to risk. Again, it's a shell game, but it's a delicate dance because there are things that you can bring to the table when you do bring cameras and you do bring notepads to shine light on a particular issue. And so, sure, when Roy Wilkins would go to Mississippi, the attention would be on Roy Wilkins when he left the focus still was, or the responsibility was still of Medgar Evers to do the actual job. Now, you raised the point about being in the media, about, you know, what we do on the sidelines. It is critical, though, for an Ed Gorton to do what he does, for what I do at the Chicago Defender and on TV One in my syndicated column, because we provide the platforms for these individuals. And so Kevin Powell has the opportunity. For instance, when Kevin had his manhood conference here in Chicago, I put it on the front page.
And we appreciated that, brother.
So if I wasn't in the position,
yes,
and I wasn't understanding what he was trying to do, I could not have done it, put it on the front page. And so, no, we play a critical role, because were it not for black newspapers and black radio and African Americans of Conscience, you would not have had a king. John H. Johnson, in many ways, built Martin Luther King, gave
That's
him
right.
the platform
That's
to do
right.
what he did. So
yes,
we
sir.
Are very critical in the struggle.
Yes, sir.
And I think that's important, because grassroots folks need that information and insight so they really know what's going on, because part of the problem, they don't get the information. And there are a lot of folks, like both of you all said, that are out there doing a lot of work. In Philadelphia, I can say, and in Pittsburgh, that are really out there helping folks, working with the homeless or working with substance abusers, as our company does, those type of things. And people don't really know what's going on, so they need to know.
All right. Let's turn our attention now to something that's been going on, and we've heard the president talk about this for quite some time, and that's tort reform. Quite frankly, most people, I don't think, know what tort is when we talk about it. But we should note that the number of tort trials in federal courts has fallen about 80%, less than 2 decades ago. A government study that was released this week, we should suggest that it's a trend that the Bush administration has been pushing for some time, and they want to see it move down to state and local levels. Much of this decline is due to, most experts suggest, the Supreme Court rulings that made it much more difficult for people to bring lawsuits in federal courts to prevail. Some are suggesting that plaintiffs are simply avoiding federal courts. And we should note that most of these trials involve personal injuries such as product liability, car accidents, medical malpractice, et cetera. Renee, when you take a look at just the idea that we are a suing nation, is this a good idea in your opinion?
Yeah, I personally think it should come to the state and local levels of government around there so they can handle the situation. But I also think it's important for people to be able to get their cases in there. There are some folks, Ed, that take advantage of it, and we all know that. And the problem was the courts were overrun with folks taking advantage of it, with these personal injuries that were not true or whatever, and spending a lot of money and time and energy on this. So I think if it comes down to local and state, I think that makes more sense, and that people are able to get their lawsuits on the table and get them done quicker.
Roland, but any concern, though, if we move too far in this and take it down to all levels, that it really is a plus for big business and the small man has no idea of reciprocating the push and pull of what needs to be legally?
Well, it is being taken down already to the state mm-hmm. and local level. And understand, tort reform has nothing to do with the number of lawsuits being filed. The business interests are backing tort reform because they don't like the massive judgments that they are being hit with. And so when you have the efforts to cap judgments on the federal level, on the state level, that was a measure passed in Texas where if you sue regarding a hospital or a doctor, they're going to put a cap at $250,000. And people are saying, wait a minute, but if I have lifelong injuries that require rehabilitation, that's not going to do enough. And so the effort by big business to push President Bush and other Republicans and some Democrats to tort reform has to do with cutting the judgments, not necessarily the lawsuits.
Kevin?
I agree with Brother Roland. I think that it's going to really send a mixed signal to folks who really have serious claims. And I just, when you look at the Bush administration over these 2 terms, it has been deeply in bed with big businesses. And I think about the fact that many of these cases we're talking about have to do with the medical and pharmaceutical industries, which have been big supporters of the Bush administration. So I really think it's a way to prevent people or discourage people from filing legitimate claims. And really, to me, it's a slap against regular folks in this country, regular Americans.
Mm-hmm. Renee?
I don't think it's a slap in the face, and I think that people will all have an opportunity to do that, to get their cases in front of folks. Again, I feel that if it is on as it is moving to the state and local areas, that people have a better opportunity. I hear what you're both saying as far as big businesses and the pharmaceutical and medical folks, but the bottom line is that in some areas you really do need to cap some of these cases because they've just gone to extreme.
Well, and I will say this, as relates to the local and state judges, understand these federal judges are appointed, obviously, based upon who's in the White House, so it's by ideology. But in many of these state and local governments, the individuals are elected. And so then you have these same companies who are putting money into the campaign coffers, and these individuals are in many ways beholden to the people who put them in office. And so it's not as if, trust me, I believe there are a number of lawsuits that are dumb, that are ridiculous, that should be tossed out. But again, if it's about that, that's a different issue. But when you start saying let's start capping awards, then you're really mixing the two. Make a decision. Is it about ending the number of lawsuits or is it really about going after those judgments?
Here's something that's interesting that we found coming out of Pakistan. U.S. officials are suggesting there is a need to reform the educational system there, that they are suggesting that in the history books and in other textbooks in the public school system that Pakistani children are learning things such as, and this is directly out of the book, that Jews are tight-fisted moneylenders and Christians are vengeful conquerors. One book suggests that kids should be willing to die as martyrs for Islam. And Americans and U.S. officials obviously, or I should say U.S. officials, want to see this change. Their belief is that the jihad, as we have generically called it now, is being taught in some of these schools. Kevin?
Well, I feel this way about tech curriculum around the country, around the world. I don't think any society should teach hatred or bigotry or intolerance in any form, and that goes for Pakistan, that goes for us in the United States, but we still have problems in our curriculum system as well. And I think that, you know, certainly when we're talking about the situation in Pakistan and other countries, which we certainly have supported through the years, we being the United States government, there should be some encouragement to be tolerant of the three major religions that came out of that region: Islam, Christianity, and Judaism.
Roland, the idea and
I think any U.S. official who has the audacity and the unmitigated gall to criticize someone else's school system when we continue to teach that Christopher Columbus discovered America,
which was
a lie. If you want to check somebody else's textbooks and their school system, why don't you check your own? And so, and see, we have very subtle ways of teaching the same type of hatred for certain people based upon omission as opposed to actually including it. I certainly don't endorse, and I think we should always discourage, the teaching of terrorism and hatred. But see, this is directed toward Pakistan. You also must say the same thing that's being done by our great, lovely partner, Saudi Arabia. But see, we really don't say anything about them because they give us massive amounts of oil and we get to have our bases there in the Middle East. But again, I think you have to attack it. But again, if you want to criticize their textbooks, open your eyes and look at your own in America.
So, Renee, isn't this a catch-22, the idea that you want to, as you say, and as Kevin has articulated already, you want to denounce hatred, particularly in a form of teaching young children this, yet it is difficult to stand and be self-righteous when you know, as Roland suggests, that there are lies throughout American textbooks from time immemorial?
I definitely agree. We cannot be teaching hatred, but we also need to look at our system. It is a catch-22. We do have some serious issues, and we need to look at our issues and start dealing with those issues and not to justify those issues. And that means to really stay on the education system, look at what folks are putting out as far as looking at the administration and those type of things, and definitely what is the solution. Looking at some solutions, we've been talking about the racism, the hatred being taught in our schools because it's passive aggressive. People tend not to deal with it, but what are some of the solutions so that it can be started to be dealt with?
Go ahead, Roland. I bet you're going to get to my question. Go ahead.
Well, I just think, again, that one of the things that we have done, in my estimation, with this Iraq war, is we have lost the moral authority to make such judgments. I think people will respect your opinion and respect your viewpoint when you have dealt with it yourself. But I think too often what we do in this country, like we will criticize human rights abuses in China and Indonesia and mm-hmm. other countries, right. yet we don't categorize mm-hmm. police brutality as a human rights abuse. Right. You know, and so again, and so when the president of when the head of China came to the United States when President Clinton was in office, they said, "Well, let's talk about Tiananmen Square." He said, "Let's talk about Rodney King." You know, they were like, "Oh, I'm sorry, my bad. You should have brought that up."
And, you know, so I'm here in New York City, Ed, and the thing I think about is that before September 11th, many African Americans had tremendous problems with Arab or Middle Eastern cab drivers and shop owners, for example. And I often had conversations with them. They would learn that I had at one point been a Muslim in my life, and I said, "Where did you get this education from? This opinion about African Americans?" They said, "We were taught that this is who you were." And so it's really interesting to me for us, as Roland's alluding to say. That we're going to tell people how they should be educated when we really still perpetuate that African Americans are inferior in this country.
And Renee, let me ask you, Roland raises an interesting point, and as the casualties continue to mount in this war, the moral authority of this president in terms of how America is looking at him, that is part and parcel of all of this, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the administration really needs to look at all the issues, what's going on in Iraq, not just the whole educational piece, but also, you know, looking at are we really making sure that we're bringing freedom and democracy and ending the tyranny over there? Are we are giving new life to folks? Are we are focused on things like improving women's rights and holding fair elections and drafting a constitution? And I think it's time for us to stop being, as Margaret Thatcher would say, now it's time to stop being wobbly and do what we need to do.
And Ed, right. I mean, again, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, real quick, Roland, for me.
Well, it's just we talk about the moral authority. Again, you can't stand up to the world and say why we're doing this and we invaded the country because of this, but then we found out that it was a different reason. And again, we lose our credibility, and when you lose your credibility, they cease to listen to you.
All right. Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender, Renee Amor, president of the Amor Group, and Kevin Powell, author of Who's Going to Take the Weight? Manhood, Race, and Power in America. I thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.